everyone. This is DJ Shy John, and this is the Kill Radio Weekly News in Review. We're going to start the top of the news today with Harper's Weekly Review, September 25th, 2012. Mother Jones Magazine posted online a leaked video in which Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney tells guests at a fundraising dinner that 47% of Americans are dependent on federal aid and see themselves as victims. "My job is not to worry about those people," Romney says. "I'll never convince them that they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives." Romney also reminds guests that his father was born in Mexico. "Had he been born of Mexican parents, I'd have a better shot of winning this," he says. "I say that jokingly, but it'd be helpful to be Latino." 2 days later, Romney was accused of appearing in brownface for an interview on the Spanish-language TV channel Univision. "If we can't win this election," said Obama campaign co-chairman Ted Strickland, "God help us." As violent protests against an American film mocking the Prophet Muhammad spread through the Muslim world, the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo published cartoons depicting the Prophet naked, including one captioned, "Muhammad, a star is born," in which a prostrating man displays his genitals and anus. "What are we supposed to do when there's news like this?" asked editor-in-chief Gerard Biard. "Are we supposed to not do that news?" The French government closed schools, embassies, consulates, and cultural centers in 20 countries. Interior Minister Manuel Valls banned domestic demonstrations, and the Louvre opened a new wing dedicated to Islamic art. In Pakistan, at least 20 people were killed at rallies honoring a new national holiday, Love for the Prophet Day. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad argued that America's protection of derogatory religious imagery as free speech is clearly a deception. And Iran's government planned to block access to Google and build the country's own internet. A court ordered New York City's Metropolitan Transportation Authority to display controversial ads sponsored by conservative blogger Pamela Geller in the subway system. "In any war between the civilized man and the savage, support the civilized man," end quote, read the ads. "Support Israel, defeat jihad," end quote. "We recognize the free speech issues," said a representative of the Council on American Islamic Relations, "and her right to be a bigot and a racist." I must ask, does that give her the right to post it in the subway? Belarus held a parliamentary election in which opponents of notoriously corrupt President Alexander Lukashenko urged constituents not to bother voting and suggested instead that they pick mushrooms or make beetroot soup. Singer Fiona Apple threatened to expose the perpetrators of inappropriate and probably illegal treatment she claimed to have received in a Texas jail after being arrested for possession of hash. "I'll make you bleep famous anytime you ask," said Apple. "Honey," replied Hudspeth County Sheriff's Department Public Information Officer Rusty Fleming, "I'm already more famous than you." Pink Floyd's old house was put up for sale, and former Duran Duran bassist John Taylor told the press he had decided to start thinking of himself as middle-aged. "It was actually a good decision to make," said Taylor, "because I'd been feeling like a very tired young man." British researchers found that a significant percentage of headaches are caused by pain relief medication. Climatologists explained that the hole in the ozone layer keeps Antarctic ice from melting. And a police officer from the South Pacific nation of Kiribati claimed that a shark saved his life while he was stranded at sea. The Teachers Foundation of Malaysia began hosting seminars for parents and educators on how to spot homosexual tendencies, noting that gay men favor V-necks and big handbags. And an Italian study revealed that penis size has shrunk by 10% in the last 50 years. has to be the feminazis, said conservative radio host Rush Limbaugh of The Statistic. I mean, the chickification, everything else. Harvard Divinity School professor Karen King announced that a 4th century scrap of papyrus given to her by an anonymous donor contains a line written in Coptic in which Jesus, heretofore believed to be unmarried, refers to my wife. There are thousands of scraps of papyrus, said Coptic linguist Wolf Peter Funk, where you find crazy things. Is that what they use for the internet then? An Akron, Ohio woman revealed that she had been married unknowingly for several years to her own father. And in Sweden, two women were implanted with their mother's wombs. Less than an hour after giant panda Mei Zhang sounded a distress honk in her den at the Smithsonian Zoo, her cub died unexpectedly. We're going to make it a point, said one visitor, to buy as many panda things as we possibly can today. A man who was mauled by a tiger and suffered a collapsed lung and broke a shoulder, a rib, an ankle, and his pelvis after jumping from the monorail into the tiger den at the Bronx Zoo was charged with trespassing. The tiger, said the zoo's director, did nothing wrong in this episode. Two hunters, one in Utah and another in Bordeaux, France, were shot by their own dogs. It wasn't the dog's fault, said the French sportsman, whose hand had to be amputated. He is adorable. In Largo, Florida, a woman named Hope O'Kelly pieced together $300 that her beagle had eaten out of her purse following relentless scrutiny of his excrement. We found a pile of vomit, said O'Kelly, and I was like, yes! That article was written by Sarah Bressler. Now, in other news, I have a very short article from the Los Angeles Times, dated September 19th, from Politicale, on politics in the Golden State. Poll shows close call for Jerry Brown's tax plan. Roughly half of California's likely voters support Governor Jerry Brown's tax initiative, according to a new poll, making its success a toss-up less than 2 months before the election. Poll, released Wednesday night by the Public Policy Institute of California, said 52% supported the measure, putting passage within a 4.4% margin of error. An additional 40% said they were against the initiative, and 8% said they didn't know how they would vote. Brown's tax initiative, Proposition 30, would increase the sales tax by a quarter cent and raise income taxes by 1 to 3 percentage points for residents earning more than $250,000. If the taxes don't pass, Brown says there will be almost $6 billion in budget cuts, mostly to public education. Another tax proposal, Proposition 38, had less support than Brown's. The poll said 45% of likely voters favored the initiative and 45% opposed it. Proposition 38 is being pushed by the California State PTA and Molly Munger, a civil rights attorney from Pasadena. It would raise income taxes for most residents to increase spending on early childhood education and public schools. Turnout will be an important ingredient in determining the November outcome of the two tax measures, since these initiatives have much stronger support among young, Latino, and women voters, and narrow majorities of independent voters are favoring both measures today. Mark Baldassare, the Public Policy Institute of California president and chief executive officer, said in a statement. I have a couple more articles here. They're from a while back. This one, I think, is important that you know. This is from HuffPost Politics. It is back from June, and it says austerity's big winners prove to be Wall Street and the wealthy. Well, maybe it's not news. I don't know. Washington. The poor and middle class have shouldered by far the heaviest burdens of the global political obsession with austerity policies over the past 3 years. In the United States, budget cuts have forced states to reduce education, public transportation, affordable housing, and other social services. In Europe, welfare cuts have driven some severely disabled individuals to fear for their lives. But the austerity game also has winners. Cutting or eliminating government programs that benefit the less disadvantaged has long been an ideological goal of conservatives. Doing so also generates a tidy windfall for the corporate class, as government services are privatized and savings from austerity pay for tax cuts for the wealthiest citizens. U.S. financial interests that stand to gain from Medicare, Medi-Cal, and Social Security cutbacks have been the core of the big con. The propaganda that these programs are in crisis and must be slashed, said James Galbraith, an economist at the University of Texas. Advocates of austerity measures have sold their proposals as a means to improve the economy. It is an error to think that fiscal austerity is a threat to growth and job creation, declared European Central Bank President Jean-Claude Trichet in July of 2010. We're going to cut spending to get the debt down, help create jobs and prosperity, and reform government programs, vowed Representative Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, chairman of the House Budget Committee, in a February 2011 commentary for Real Clear Politics. Ryan would later declare that his budget plan, with far more aggressive austerity measures than those ultimately enacted by Congress, including $6.2 trillion in spending cuts, would have spurred $1.5 trillion in economic growth and created 2.5 million jobs. As for the 2010 Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction plan, it is often described by Beltway insiders as a centrist proposal that would bring the country together and improve the economy. In fact, Simpson-Bowles is yet another austerity program that would cut Medicare and Social Security while securing tax breaks for corporations and the well-off, according to an analysis by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Erskine Bowles, co-chairman of the bipartisan commission that worked on the plan as a director at Morgan Stanley, the sixth largest American bank and a financial institution for which the United States made huge commitments to help it weather the economic downturn. Morgan Stanley took $10 billion in bailout funds under the Troubled Asset Relief Program and received more than $100 billion a day in cheap loans from the Federal Reserve at the height of the past financial crisis. For weeks, Morgan Stanley borrowed more money from the Fed than the company's stock market value. That solicitude for the profits of big corporations shows up in Simpson-Bowles, too. The plan offers multiple corporate tax reform proposals, but one which calls for shifting a so-called territorial tax system would be especially advantageous to Morgan Stanley and the other Wall Street banks. It would allow U.S. companies to permanently avoid paying U.S. taxes on overseas income, including money stashed in offshore tax havens like the Cayman Islands. According to a 2008 report by the Government Accountability Office, Morgan Stanley operates 273 sub-companies headquartered in such tax havens. While Social Security advocates have attacked the plan, the Business Roundtable, a lobbying group for corporate CEOs, has praised Simpson-Bowles. So has Peter Peterson, who served as Richard Nixon's Commerce Secretary before founding Blackstone Group, a major private equity firm. Peterson has long advocated cuts to Social Security and Medicare, and he started a think tank devoted to federal debt reduction in 2008. I'm a great fan of Erskine Bowles, said Alan Simpson. Peterson told Bloomberg in 2011, I think they're American heroes. As many economists predicted, however, the austerity policies implemented after the financial crisis have proved to be a losing proposition for the global economy. The strong economic growth that austerity advocates predicted has not materialized, with the United States showing only anemic improvements and European countries sliding back into devastating recessions. At the same time, corporate profits in the financial industry remain above even the levels reached at the height of the housing bubble. According to Commerce Department data, and elites on both sides of the Atlantic have secured generous tax breaks made possible in part by cuts to social services. Well, in part. In the, it's also in part of deregulation, too, right? In the United States, President George W. Bush's tax breaks for the wealthiest citizens were extended, while unemployment benefits and even food stamps have gone on the chopping block. This trade-off is even more apparent at the state level. In 2010, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Republican, opted not to make the $3 billion annual contribution to the state workers' pension fund, instead securing $1 billion in tax cuts for the state's better-off residents. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, Republican, has similarly proposed budgets that provide tax breaks for corporations and the rich while demanding pay and benefit cuts for middle-class state workers. Austerity policies are literally a redistribution from the bottom of the income spectrum to the top, said Dorian Warren, a professor of political science at Columbia University and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, an economic policy think tank. In Wisconsin, both wealthy people and businesses got tax breaks, while middle-class and working-class employees of the state essentially got crushed. Warren emphasized that there are political dimensions to the austerity push. Efforts to curb collective bargaining rights and thus pay and benefits for state employees cut to the heart of the American labor movement. With only 7% of the private sector workforce unionized, public sector unions are a critical component of labor's political influence and an important block in Democratic Party operations. Governments in Europe, most notably the United Kingdom, have also pursued tax cuts for the rich while imposing austerity measures on the working classes. And the European financier class has benefited even more directly than their American counterparts from these budgets. Every time the European Union has reached a crisis point on the debt carried by Greece or Spain, EU leaders, especially German Chancellor Angela Merkel, have come to the rescue with bailout funds. That money goes to the banks that own Greek and Spanish debt, whose holdings would take a hit if either country were unable to repay. But the bailout comes with harsh austerity requirements intended to encourage budgetary discipline, so it's ordinary citizens who end up taking the hit. The most vulnerable populations are harmed by the bailouts, while the well-paid financial professionals who made the deals to finance Greek and Spanish deficits in the first place continue profiting handsomely. Imposing pain on Greeks is a blood price for the ever-repeated bailouts, whose actual beneficiaries are said to be Greeks, but are in fact French and German bankers, said Galbraith. The consequences have been dire. In Greece, HIV/AIDS infections have soared 1,500% since the end of 2010, as public health programs and anti-drug campaigns have been decimated. Unemployment has risen above 20% in both Greece and Spain. Yet none of this has slowed the bipartisan American political movement for greater austerity. The U.S. budget will reach the so-called fiscal cliff at the end of the year when a number of tax breaks expire and harsh budget cuts under the 2011 debt ceiling deal kick in. Republicans in Congress are calling for additional slashing of federal spending, and they have been joined by Wall Street Democrats, former Representative Harold Ford Jr., Democrat Tennessee, now a managing director at Morgan Stanley, who supported the American bank bailout, advocated for austerity during a June appearance on NBC's Meet the Press. Obviously, we hope that things will go well there in Greece, Ford said. And when I say well, I mean that the austerity camp wins out. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm disgusted. And to go on to more disgusting news here, I don't know if I'm going to get through this whole article. It's very long, but kind of important. I've been meaning to read it to you. This is from TheHill.com, business and lobbying. The Hill's 50th Wealthiest Lawmakers by Kevin Bogardus and Megan R. Wilson. Now, this is from August 21st. Republicans dominate The Hill's annual rankings of the 50 wealthiest lawmakers for the second year in a row, with Representative Michael McCaul, Republican, Texas, retaining the crown as the richest member of Congress. This year's wealthy list tilts decisively once again toward the right side of the aisle, with 31 of the 50 richest coming from the GOP. 31 of the lawmakers on the list are from the House, and with the remaining 19 coming from the Senate. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Kentucky, at number 37, is the only Republican leader to make the top 50. The Republican Party's fastest-rising star, GOP vice presidential candidate and Wisconsin Representative Paul Ryan, comes nowhere near making the list, having a net worth of at least $2.2 million, a modest sum, among members of Congress. McCall reported a minimum net worth of $290.5 million for 2011, a more than $3 million jump from the 2010 that kept him nearly $100 million ahead of his nearest challenge, Democratic Senator John Kerry, Massachusetts. The Texas Republican's wealth stems from several family trusts. His father-in-law, Lowry Mays, is the founder of the radio broadcasting giant Clear Channel Communications. That's why I wanted to read this to you. Kerry, the runner-up, reported a net worth of at least $198.8 million for 2011, much of it coming from wife Teresa Heinz Kerry's ties to the Heinz ketchup fortune. The senator is the richest Democrat in Congress by a sizable margin and topped the Hill's wealthiest lists in 2009 and 2010 before being dethroned by McCall last year. The Massachusetts senator reclaimed the number two spot on this year's list from Representative Daryl Issa, Republican California, who saw his minimum net worth fall by almost $80 million. Issa, a powerful House chairman who made his fortune in car security systems, had at least $140.6 million in 2011, placing him third on the Hill's list. Issa listed four liabilities on his financial disclosure form, including $75 million in loans that he reported paying off in early 2011. Every liability that is reported on a lawmaker's yearly disclosure report is counted against his or her wealth under the Hill's methodology. This is the first time the Hill has published its rankings in the midst of a presidential election year. The race between Republican Mitt Romney and President Obama has been dominated by a debate over wealth and how it should be taxed, with Obama calling for higher taxes on the wealthy. The Hill reviewed lawmakers' 2011 calendar year financial disclosure forms to develop the rankings. Lawmakers do not have to report exact figures for their assets and liabilities on the forms, instead providing the values in ranges. To calculate the wealth of each lawmaker, the Hill uses the low figure in the value range for each asset and liability. The liabilities are subtracted from the assets to reach a minimum net worth. Some lawmakers chose to provide exact figures for their holdings, often by attaching bank statements to their disclosure forms. In those cases, the Hill used exact figures when possible to calculate a lawmaker's wealth. A new wrinkle for this year's wealthiest list was that lawmakers had to disclose mortgage on their personal residence for the first time. That was required by the Stock Act in response to the countrywide scandal in which lawmakers and congressional aides received preferential treatment on their mortgages. This year's list includes a few newcomers. Democratic Representative Shelley Pingree, Maine, clocked in at number 12 after coming nowhere near the top 50 in 2010. Her net worth skyrocketed from at least $500,000 to $31.8 million last year after her marriage to hedge fund manager Donald Sussman. They're in the royalty. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat Oregon, meanwhile, returned to the list at number 22 with a minimum net worth of $14.5 million. His spouse's holding in the famed Strand Bookstore in New York City jumped from a minimum value of $1 million to being worth at least $5. His wife, Nancy Bass Wyden, helps run the store. Other lawmakers posted impressive gains. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat Connecticut, solidified his status among the very wealthiest lawmakers with a net worth of at least $80.1 million in 2011, a spike of almost $25 million from 2010. The former Connecticut State Attorney General stayed on the top 10, coming in at number 6. One of Blumenthal's Senate colleagues, Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, also had a good run last year. His wealth increased by more than $9 million to $85.9 million, placing him fourth on the list. Some lawmakers didn't fare as well and reported substantial losses. Representative Vern Buchanan, Republican Florida, who was cleared in July by the House Ethics Committee of misleading Congress about his finances, slipped out of the top 10 after reporting a drop of more than $5 million in his net worth. The congressman's $36.5 million fortune ranks him 11th, just behind freshman Representative Jim Renacci, Republican Ohio, who was worth at least $36.7 million in 2011. Due to the limitations of the forms, it's likely that some lawmakers are far richer than the Hill's list indicates. Senator Herb Cole, Democrat Wisconsin, as owner of the Milwaukee Bucks, is certainly one of the richest members of Congress, but his status as an NBA basketball team owner only counts for $50 million under the value ranges given on financial disclosure forms. Fortune magazine estimates the team is worth nearly $270 million. Coupled with some substantial liabilities, Cole ends up having a minimum net worth of $10.1 million for 2011, placing him at number 32 on the list. Well, we have an update here, too. This story was corrected on Friday, August 24th, to show that Rep. Jared Polis, Democrat Colorado, has a minimum net worth of $72.2 million. Incorrect information appeared in an earlier version of this story. I won't go on to cheer you up with the whole entire list of 50. Kind of makes me sad. But in any case, I wanted to give the credits to the Kill Radio Organization news team. KillRadio.org, Harper's.org, Weekly News and Review, The Levine Breaking News, HuffingtonPost.com from HuffPost Politics, TheHill.com, Facebook, and contributors Bennett Thiessen and Randy Stites, research assistant. And that winds up the weekly news, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good week and be good to one another.